Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we'll hear from Camden School Superintendent Katrina McCombs. New Jersey has issued guidelines for reopening school buildings in the fall. Also, Inquirer sports columnist Marcus Hayes talks about the boys of summer, COVID-19, and spring training in July. The Phillies get to work on Wednesday. But to begin, the Philadelphia School District is shifting its attitude around school policing. With the start of the new school year, safety officers will replace school police in buildings and on playgrounds. The uniforms will be different, and the role of such officers will focus more on mentoring and social support and less on apprehension and harsh punishment. Kevin Bethel is chief of school safety for Philadelphia Public Schools. Before that, he spent years working at the Philadelphia Police Department, winning national attention for developing a program which made a sizable dent in the number of students arrested in Philly schools. Kevin Bethel joins us now for the Regional Roundup, and it is a pleasure to have you with us.
And thank you for having me.
So, Kevin, let's begin by talking about the desire to move away from a law and order mentality when it comes to keeping Philly's schools and school children safe. What does not work with this approach?
I think, well, naturally, the problem you had is when you put police officers in the school setting and very oftentimes with very little training and really understanding of adolescent development, you often find that that has resulted in, you know, children being arrested in the school. But our model in Philadelphia is obviously demonstrably different because we don't have Philadelphia police officers in the schools. Philadelphia Police Department has been a great partner. They support us, but most of the work is done by school safety officers now. They were formerly titled school police officers. We've changed that name. And so we've been able to really, not criminalize much of the behavior in our schools by using a diversion program with the Department of Human Services and run by the Philadelphia Police Department to move children into services rather than being criminalized and put into the system.
Also, Kevin, tell us about the uniform change. I don't know if that's happened yet and what the change in the visual might mean for students.
I mean, we clearly understand, and many departments across the nation use a softer uniform. Obviously, you know, being in policing for myself, even after 30 years, I often would realize how intimidating wearing a uniform can be. And also the trauma that oftentimes, particularly folks, it impacts on others. So we'll be moving to a softer uniform, for lack of a better term, a uniform that is particularly starting in our K-8 schools, which will make us less threatening for many of our students. And that uniform will be, in most cases, a polo shirt and a pair of khakis. And really, just really making sure that we can connect to the children in a different way.
How do members of the safety officer staff view their jobs and their role? And again, just clarify for us a little bit, how do you want them to view it?
I want them to view it as, I often tell folks, I look at it through the lens of how I want my child to be treated in a setting, whether it be a school setting or anywhere. And if you use that lens, it often can open your mind to understand that I want our environment to understand, adolescent development, to understand that our kids do some crazy things sometimes, but it's not done out of malice. Most times it's the manifestation of a trauma inflicted on them, and it just manifests itself in the school. So we want them to be mentors. We want them to be individuals who young people can come to and talk to when there's needs. But I would have to say that many of my men and women, I took over in November, but I've known these men and women for a long time. Many of them are doing this as well. Many of them have already volunteered to be mentors. Many of them do things with these young people that were absolutely amazing. We had officers who, even during when school closed, worked with a lot of the kids virtually, just reaching out to them. And so I think this is just really taking the energy that already exists within the department and really, really expand them out to be able to do more. And all the time, it's on leadership, right? They have done what we've asked them to do. And now we're asking them to do something different, but you'll often find, as I found even when I was doing the diversion work in the field of the police department, mm-hmm. that many of the men and women wanted to do something, but we just didn't give them the ability to do that.
So when you say ability, are you talking guidelines? Are you talking sitting down with staff meetings and really defining how the role has changed?
Yeah, I think what happens oftentimes, I remember when I first brought the Philadelphia police officers, school officers who support the schools, not in the schools, and talked about wanting to do this diversion program, and really realized the only tool that they had at the time was you know, is mandated by the state to notify the police department to make arrests. The officer arrives and he or she made the arrest. It was amazing when I said, well, we have a different tool and we're going to be able to divert. They would be the greatest ambassadors for that work. So I think oftentimes we have to give them the ability to make different decisions. We have to give them the ability to use discretion. We have to give them the training and the tools to be effective in doing that work. But as leaders, we have a responsibility to really expand their toolbox so that when they are making and want to make a different decision, you know, they have a child in front of them and they can look at them and see that something is wrong because they've gotten the training to understand that and to make a different decision. So it's my responsibility, my leadership team responsibility, to give the men and women who work for us the ability to work with young people in a way that's more effective than just arresting and criminalizing that behavior.
So as this change has been underway over the past, months, at least since you got into, you assumed the job in November, what have you been hearing from students, if anything?
Well, actually, I have to take you back. Unfortunately, you know, in 2014, before I left the police department, you know, working under then Commissioner Ramsey and Commissioner Ross, and even now under Commissioner Outlaw, you know, we started a diversion program, you know, in 2014, when at the time, you know, the year prior was 1,600 students arrested.
Philly last students.
1,600 Philadelphia students in 2013 were arrested. Last year, we had only 251. So we've had an 84% reduction in the number of students who have been arrested in our schools. Many of those who are arrested, unfortunately, are for some of the more serious offenses, where they assaulted another student or assaulted a teacher or principal or staff or something of that nature. And so we've been blessed in our work with the Department of Human Services, the DA's offices, and others, particularly with the Department of Human Services, to move those young people into programs. So I've been fortunate to meet those men and women, those students. And I can tell you they're doing phenomenally well. And many of them oftentimes need some extra support. You know, DHS goes into the homes and meet with the family. There's oftentimes needs that are not being met. A grandmother who's unfortunately, who may be raising four or five children, that's not unfortunate, but they're raising four or five children and they need help. And so DHS has really been able to get in there and working with the Intensive Preventive Services Program. We have five programs around the city that we're able to move those. So we've been able to meet those students, and many of them are doing well. And many of them, for the first time, see a law enforcement officer in a totally different mindset. I mean, you imagine a child who's having all these difficulties at home, and they meet one of the officers, particularly the Philadelphia Police Department officers who divert, and they divert that child. I mean, you can hear the stories from my men and women, and well, not my men and women anymore, but the Philadelphia Police Department officers who come back and for the first time realize, wow, you know, I was able to change a child's life.
Oh, positive. Such a positive in these times.
It's such a positive. Yeah. I mean, it is. So the program's been so positive, and that's why, you know, I was able to start it. But it's the men and women in the Philadelphia Police Department, it's the school safety office, it's the school district, it's DHS, it's others who really have made it into a program that, and, you know, even today, my phone continues to call all last week, because other jurisdictions want to say, hey, what are you doing in Philadelphia so different than what we're doing?
So, Kevin Bethel, let's just get to the nuts and bolts. We don't have a whole lot of time. Anywhere we go, in any town, in any city, we're going to find young people who might be troubled, who might act out, who might you know, get into a fight. If a situation does escalate, how do you want your safety officer to react?
I want them to slow down. I want them to use their training and the tools that they've been provided and look at that child from the lens of what happened to you. You know, not that oftentimes we look at the lens of what did he do. But when you take a more trauma-focused lens and you think about what happened to you, is when you can really start to get to the root of those issues. And then I want those officers, particularly for these low-level offenses, which absolutely don't need any reason whatsoever for them to go into the criminal justice system, that we can turn those into programs within the school. We're fortunate enough to create a youth court at 440 now, so we're able to divert young people into our youth court where young people serve as the court. But I want them to make a different decision. I don't want them criminalizing normal adolescent behavior and putting children into a system in which many times we know they will never get out.
So de-escalation as opposed to apprehension.
Absolutely. And that has to be the case.
What is your position on metal detectors? I mean, most city high schools do have them. Some people say they make kids feel criminalized. Do you envision a time when they might not be needed?
I don't. It's a very hard question. It's been a difficult question, you know, even as the school board has wrestled with that question. And we've great energy from Herb Ed and Philadelphia Student Union around the issue of metal detectors. And what I can tell you is that, you know, in our urban centers, particularly across the nation, where we have used metal detectors, we have not had any of the mass murder incidences that we've seen across the country. Unfortunately, we do get a number of weapons to come into the school setting. We have, on average, received 2 guns a year coming into our school setting. And we've had an unfortunate incident that prompted why we had metal detectors in 1999. There was a vice principal who was shot in his leg as a result of a child having a gun in the school. And so I think what is really key is how we treat those children when they come through the metal detector, and we treat them in a humane and dignified and appropriate manner.
With a good morning and a how are you?
Absolutely. You know that starts today, right? And so we really going to take a step back with pictures and create an environment where it's not, and we do not criminalize that. So even though we may find a knife or we may find other devices, we divert all those kids. Last year, we only arrested 9 students coming through the metal detector for a system that used to do well over 200. So we just making sure that it's not a criminalized process, that is there to keep not just them safe, the teachers safe, the principal safe, the community safe.
Sure.
We hope to see as the future, when we go into the future, we'll continue to assess the metal detectors. But I think at this point, our responsibility is to make sure that, you know, it's a safe environment, but making sure that we treat those children as humane as possible and that it's not a trap when they come in. And we use a very just model so they know what they can and cannot bring into the school. And it serves as a deterrent and a safety apparatus and not a device that people have criminalized in, which we have shifted away over the last 4 years totally from that process.
We only have about 45 seconds left, but there are those who say, Kevin, you know, a safety officer might not be a police officer, but they do take issue with the word officer. They say officers don't belong in Philadelphia's public schools. How do you respond to that?
I think we could play on the words. I was a police officer for 30 years. I believe I serve honorably, and I believe that many and most of the men and women across this nation and in Philadelphia do as well. So I don't take, you know, the issue of officer, whether he's officer, whatever you may or call him or her, it is how they treat the individuals in that school, is how they're respected in that school setting and what they do in that school setting. And so I think that's more important than being hung up on the term officer, because at the end of the day, you know, we all want what's right for the student. And so I hear those concerns, but again, I served as an officer for 30 years. Yeah. I'm a police officer, a former officer, and I run the unit. I run the department.
We unfortunately are out of time, but we thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for the time.
Kevin Bethel is chief of school safety for Philadelphia Public Schools. Up next, Camden School Superintendent Katrina McComb. Schools are reopening in New Jersey in September.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're starting to get a better picture of how the school day will look in the fall for New Jersey's 1.5 million public school students. And the new normal is daunting. COVID-19 will almost certainly still be with us. And Governor Murphy on Friday released long-awaited guidelines for the reopening of school buildings. Students will need to stay 6 feet apart in class, on the bus, and during recess and gym. And they'll be strongly encouraged to wear masks, a requirement for teachers and other staff. There will be frequent disinfecting, and there will be screening for coronavirus. And it's a lot to take in, so we thought we'd ask Camden School Superintendent Katrina McCombs to join us with her thoughts. And later on, we'll also talk about the renaming of Camden's Woodrow Wilson High School. Katrina McCombs, good to have you with us again.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
So what a sea change. Education, I'm guessing, unlike anything you or your staff have ever experienced.
Absolutely. We are definitely in unprecedented times, and education especially is experiencing that.
Districts, Katrina, have apparently been working ahead while waiting for the state guidelines. Have you gotten to the point where you have some sort of idea of what a typical classroom in Camden will look like in September?
Yeah, so we have proactively, prior to the governor's and the commissioner of education's release of the road back this Friday, our plan and guidance for school reopening, to your point, we had already proactively set up school reopening task force committee, and that committee was made up very inclusively and very intentionally so, with representation from our unions, our parents, our school leaders, our teachers, and administration to make sure we get this right. So we had several contingency plans in place as we were awaiting guidance. But at the core, we knew that we had to make sure we honed in on the CDC guidance as we were thinking about how can we ensure that our students will be safe in the environment whenever we return in person. And so our ops team has really been thinking through, again, some of the contingency plans, but we know at minimum we are in alignment with CDC guidance, which requires face masks, which also requires that students be 6 feet apart, and that requires that we also spend some time thinking critically about transportation and what those transportation needs are going to look like as we're also implementing social distancing when transporting students to school. So we're in a good place because we had started doing contingency planning, and now we're at the point because the road back guidance was left pretty flexible, too, for districts to customize and tailor based on their specific needs. We have everything we need at our disposal now to solidify our plan moving forward. And that will be released once it has been fully vetted.
So initially, though, the take is that you're probably going to have fewer kids in class and fewer kids on buses if you have to keep children separated 6 feet. Is that right?
And that's absolutely correct.
So are you going to have to... How are you going to, you have a certain number of children, say if you have 300 children in one school, but you have fewer children in the classroom, are you going to have to go to staggered schedules? Are you going to focus still in part on homeschooling? How do you think you might manage that?
Again, since the guidance was released on Friday and we have had plans in place, planning committees in place, we had those contingency plans. So we do know that we will have to make sure that we're able to provide more buses, which will mean there is likely the possibility of increased costs related to transportation. And also within our buildings, we are going to have to consider different types of scheduling. We are thinking about many different preliminary aspects right now, which focus in on our students. So primarily, we want to make sure that our students who are most vulnerable, our special needs populations, our early childhood populations, our younger learners who are most vulnerable during times of remote learning, we want to make sure that we think about how can we maximize ensuring that they are back earlier. And then we want to figure out an approach to phase in our other grade levels. Again, this is very high-level preliminary, hasn't been fully vetted. Our board has to take a look at it as well. But overall, we want to prioritize the needs of our most vulnerable students.
So masks and social distancing, Katrina McCombs, will this be one of the greatest challenges facing your educators during this school day? Do children naturally gravitate toward each other?
Yeah, there will have to be a lot of training, a lot of reinforcement, a lot of just attention being given to our educators, our families, and our students on the expectations that will be necessary to make sure everyone is in place when we get back to school. Masks, of course, our students and families have become accustomed to what's been expected given our state guidelines. However, we will definitely have to make sure that everyone is in alignment and understands why it is so critical that we put these measures in place. And so, you know, there will be teaching, like I said, that's necessary, but also retraining and also just a shared collective sense of responsibility and accountability for making sure that at minimum, our students are safe. Our parents feel safe that our students are coming back into our buildings and that our staff members are also safe as well.
Let's talk about monitoring for coronavirus and even dealing with other illnesses, like, say, a case of the sniffles. I mean, it seems as if we're a little bit early in the process here. The guidelines just came out. But how do you visualize teachers and children and other staff being, say, checked for any signs of illness? Will there be temperature checks? Will there be a mandatory frequent hand washing through the day? If somebody sees sick, it seems to be sick in the classroom, is that child automatically, say, sent home or to another caregiver?
Gotcha. No, that's a very good point. And so we are going to implement temperature checks. We're also going to continue, right, because hand washing has been something that we have been focusing on and making sure that our students know the importance of hand washing, even when we try to mitigate the flu. And so this will be a time for us to, again, underscore the importance of those hygiene practices that keep us all safe. But temperature checks will be new. And we also have a system in place for, students who do come in and are not feeling well, or staff members too. We'll have to develop special quarantine areas in each of our schools so that if a student comes in, you know, while they're waiting to get fully checked out by the nurse, and then we can contact their parents, that there is a safe place within each of our buildings where they can be kind of isolated from the rest of the population until we can make sure we have contact with their parents. And for staff members, it's the same, just until we can make sure that we're connecting with someone who's able to support them. And so, again, we are really looking at basic practical ways, but everything that's in alignment with what the CDC has put out already, which will help us to be safe. But those specialized quarantine areas in each school, as well as temperature checks prior to getting on school buses, as well as prior to entering the building, those will be critical, along with encouraging our hand washing and other hygiene factors that are proven to minimize the transmission of the coronavirus. We will continue to reinforce. You know that as educators, we like signs and graphics and visuals. So we will also make sure that we're labeling areas to help students remember social distancing, and staff members too. We also want to make sure that, we are really putting in our bathrooms and also in those areas that are important for students to remember hand washing, why it's so important. Just making it visual, but another opportunity for learning, because we know that this will keep our young people safe, and that's what we want to make sure we do, healthy and safe.
We are speaking with Katrina McComb. She is superintendent of the Camden School District. And so there are, you know, there are going to be a lot of rules, so many new rules, you know, not only for teachers to absorb, but students as well, that must be complied with for safety reasons. How do you make sure, Katrina, that learning and the sense of joy that can come with learning happen despite all this distraction?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. So, learning, this is a process, right? And education is all about learning. And it's not only about learning, you know, the standards and the academic sides, but also we want to make sure that our young people learn how to keep themselves safe in any environment, in any situation. So those day-to-day survival skills, learning factors that are so critical. So what we will do is just try as best as possible to have our teachers trained to incorporate these practices into their learning, into their daily routines, so that it becomes, so that we're able to build muscle memory, not only in our staff, but in our students, as to why it is so important for us to put these measures in place to be safe. Trying to make it as fun as we possibly can is what we will do, but we know at the end of the day, what it will come down to is repetition, consistency and expectation, and also just that visual approach to making sure we're all, our students, staff, and community, we're just all on the same page as to what it will take to keep our buildings safe for our young people.
What are you hearing from the community as you go through this process in terms of concerns?
Yeah. Absolutely. So one of the biggest things that we're hearing from the community is that they want to be able to play a part in making recommendations for reopening. So many of our community members are very active and concerned about the outcomes for education for all of our children in Camden. So I mentioned before that proactively we started with our school reopening task force meetings, and those meetings have been able to invite voices from the community, parental voices, as well as, I said before, our union leads, in addition to our educators and administrators. And so that's only one way, though, to get the voice in. We are also going, looking at survey data information coming back from our families and community and parents that will give them the other another opportunity to give input on our final plan before it's fully released. And that will be, we're hoping to have that released prior to the first 4 weeks of school. At least 4 weeks prior to the beginning of the new school year. And so our community, our parent voices are so very critical. One other way that we make sure that we keep the parental and community voice involved in this planning is through our FOCs. Our FOCs are Family Operations Coordinators, and their role has been so very critical pre-COVID-19 and staying connected with the needs and the desires and the voices of our families, but also critically important during our COVID-19 remote learning, and then their voices and their strengths will be utilized to help to make sure that our parents and community voices are continuing in the process as we look forward to school reopening. So
let me just jump in because we don't have a whole lot of time, and we have a lot to cover still. If a family feels strongly that they want to keep moving, keep going with homeschooling, is that an option? And before you answer that, let me just give a station ID. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. So homeschooling, is that still an option, Katrina McCombs?
Yes, homeschooling is an option. Again, we want to make sure that we are doing everything possible to meet the varying needs of our families. And so there may be many different reasons why families are hesitant to send their students back to school when we reopen. That could be something as simple as and complicated as having elderly family members at home, or those individuals at home who are who have pre-existing conditions and lower immune systems. And so we want to make sure that there are no barriers that get in the way of our students being able to get a thorough and efficient education. So homeschooling, yes, will still be an option. We will work with each family to make sure that we are meeting the needs that are necessary for their students to continue their learning.
Let's move on to a different topic, the decision to rename Woodrow Wilson High School. And as a matter of fact, Princeton's decided to remove Wilson's name from its public affairs school, but I think Camden's beaten Princeton to it in the decision-making. How did the district come to this determination that this was the right thing to do, Katrina?
No problem. So on the heels of all of the injustices that we're seeing today with regard to just equity issues around race. We, on the heels of George Floyd's killing in our school district, we had a day of reflection. And that day was to allow our students, our staff, and our faculty to be able to step back and to kind of process what was going on in the larger context of our society, and also to think about what that means for us as educators and how we are serving Black and brown students, in especially in Camden. That's our demographic that we serve. And so out of that, one of the strong pieces that came about was wanting to make sure that our students continue to feel valued. And so having Woodrow Wilson's name attached to one of our high schools, actually our largest comprehensive high school, was a problem. It didn't sit well given the events that occurred, and also wanting to make sure we had a call to action so that our students knew that we were taking the events seriously. And so we decided to move forward with planning putting together a committee that is representative of alumni, of students, of elected officials and stakeholders who will come together and convene to provide alternatives to the name that is listed and to Woodrow Wilson's name. Also, we wanted to make sure our students had a critical role in this decision, because we want them to be able to learn all the many different ways that you can, protest and that you can have your voices heard. And so that there are certain processes, too, that go into making change and bringing about that change.
An educational process.
Yeah, absolutely. Our young people will be able to take advantage of this as a teachable moment, too, how their voices can be heard.
Are you at liberty to tell us of any of the candidates, Katrina?
Not yet, because our committee meetings haven't started, and so I don't want to get in trouble too fast. Of course, we have many names, and I can give you broad categories. We're looking at, because Woodrow Wilson High School was named after a president, we're looking at possibly another president whose name could go there. Mm-hmm. But also, we're considering all different kinds of ideas in my head as a leader prior to getting the committee input that I look forward to. We're also looking at leaders in the city of Camden who have been influential and critical players in the educational system there, or even our just system of government. So looking at local as well as national figures who are upholding those values that we want our young people to uphold as well. So I can't give a spoiler alert because we're still considering other names. And then there's also there's a consideration too to be able to have, maybe if there are corporate sponsors who want to have their names attached to our building, that way they can also partner with us, not only on just a name change, right, but also what can that corporation do to be able to help us.
I'm going to have to jump in. We're just about out of time, but we will certainly report on the name change. And Katrina McCombs, it was great to have you with us. Katrina is superintendent for Camden City Schools. Thank you so much. Welcome back to the
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
General Roundup, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Spring training picks up in the heat of July for the boys of summer. The Phillies report to camp on Wednesday, nearly 4 months after grapefruit play was halted in the midst of what was then a newly unfolding pandemic. And as players take to the field, they will be without seven teammates who have been diagnosed with COVID-19, at last count anyway. The 2020 version of Major League Baseball promises to be unlike anything a fan or player or manager has ever seen. The league and the players' union came to a grudging agreement last week for a 60-game season. The norm is 162, and there are a host of new rules designed to protect players, staff, and even fans from the coronavirus as much as possible. And there's still a chance COVID-19 could derail the whole thing. What's a fan to think? If you've got something to say and would like to join the conversation, here's the email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Marcus Hayes is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He is our guest for the rest of the hour. Hi, Marcus. Welcome back.
Well, welcome back to me and welcome back to baseball, right? How about that?
We think. Well, so listen, baseball in the age of the coronavirus, I mean, what's your take? Something's going to happen, but we're not sure really how it's going to play out, correct?
Well, I think it depends on how mature the players are willing to be and the coaches and the support staff. What's happened in Korea over the last 6 weeks is not only has Korean baseball come back, they're going to permit fans next week. So, you know, the greatest success story possible would be playoffs with fans. I don't think that's going to happen because, as you probably addressed several times over the last week, there are states, especially in the South and the West, that are not being responsible. And, you know, those are the places where baseball not only happens in more frequency than it does anywhere else, but those are the states that are having the issues and where the problems might arise that you're talking about. Now, that said, you know, these are professional athletes, and one of the joys of covering really professional anybody, entertainers, musicians, dancers, athletes, is the incredible dedication and commitment to their craft. And that's across the board. You don't get there, you don't stay there unless you are that type of person.
Yeah.
So hopefully they will be as disciplined off the field as they are in preparing to get on and be on the field.
Well, let's talk about the health protocol, Marcus, for protecting players. The manual is 101 pages long.
Yes, it's really thoughtful and very detailed and seems kind of silly at points. You know, there's, for example, you can lean on the railing in the dugout, but you have to lean on a towel.
Huh.
Afterwards. You know what I mean? I mean, unless you're going to keep that towel with you and launder it yourself, I'm not sure what you gain. You know, if you can grab the railing to get up, but you can't lean on the railing to, you know, watch the game, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I think they've tried to sort of give players a sense of how important everything is, but the reality is if you wear a mask and wash your hands, you're probably going to be okay.
Well,
and don't spit. Mary, I know it's hard for you. Don't spit.
Oh, my parents broke me of that a long time ago, Marcus. But I mean, really, as far as spitting is concerned, you know, it just seems to be, it is a fundamental part of baseball. I mean, why do they spit? Why do players spit? And if they don't, do we lose anything?
Well, as a former, very former athlete, I will tell you that spitting is just part of playing sports. And it's not gender specific either. You get dirt in your mouth. You rinse your mouth out. If you chew tobacco, which I did a few times in college, you just become, not only does it become a habit, you become expert at it. You chew sunflower seeds. You have extra saliva. You know, your body goes through its machinations and you wind up with extra mucus in your mouth and you get rid of it. It's kind of like telling a baseball player to not breathe. But again, it's part of the game. It doesn't have to be a part of the game. And these are professionals. These are adults. They can modify their behavior any way they need to preserve their profession and stay on the field.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's get to the fact that the whole, you know, they are adults. But one of the big questions is when they travel and baseball is not being played as basketball will be in a bubble down in Florida. Baseball is going to be playing at home stadiums across the country, right? And when these players are finished and they're in their hotel rooms for the night, you know, they're not supposed to be heading out into towns that might happen to be open. But, you know, you wrote a couple articles, earlier this week, kind of alluding to this. And the one this morning, actually, is entitled How Tom Brady, the Eagles and Other Athletes Are Failing Us During the Coronavirus Pandemic. And of course, we're talking about football players here, but it can go across the board. In terms of behavior, in terms of mask wearing, getting together, you know, if baseball players are out and about when they shouldn't be, and some might be, can this sink the whole thing?
It really, I mean, and if you look at what the PGA Tour, how it has failed so far, I believe four players have tested positive for coronavirus, and I think 4 to 6 caddies have tested positive for coronavirus, and one family member tested positive, so that player took himself out of the mix for a few weeks. That said, the first couple of weeks of the tour, not only were the golfers not distancing from each other, they were supposed to be distancing from their caddies. They were supposed to be pulling their own clubs from the bag. They were supposed to be doing all this stuff, and there hasn't been an epidemic, but there's a clear disdain for the rules. And they're supposed to incur penalties on the course for not social distancing. So if golf is setting that example, they were a little bit better this week in Connecticut. If golf is setting that example, you know, guys are going out in Texas to eat dinner with each other. Yeah. It's just insanity. It's as if they don't believe there's really a pandemic going on. If baseball players do that on the road, as you said, it'll just be a catastrophe. It'll be a 2-week season and we'll be done. But the other dynamic of this is, you know, if you have children, and I have children, and my kids have already gone to basketball camp, okay? A lot of people believe that because I write these columns, I'm sitting, you know, in my basement in a plastic bubble, you know, and coming out for, you know, heat-up TV meals like a survivalist. I'm not. You know, I expect, you know, my kids at some point will be carrying it if they haven't carried it already. Think about how many baseball players have children who are active in the region. How many coaches, how many support staff have children who are active in the region? What if school starting, assuming school start again, these kids are going to school, you know? So
it's mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling.
I think that's a bigger issue than guys staying in their hotels and ordering room service or going out to a bar, or maybe not a bar, but going out to a restaurant. I think the guys with kids and the support staff with kids are much more likely to be carriers. But again, you be careful, you ask your kids to be careful, and you just get through it. It's kind of a roll of the dice.
Yeah. Let's talk about the structure of the 60-game season, thinking optimistically that people will do what they need to do and we're going to get through this, the entire 60-game season. Play will be regional. The Phillies will pretty much stay on the East Coast.
Yes, the Phillies will stay on the East Coast. They'll play the American League East. I think they play Toronto and Tampa Bay. At the actual dates and times haven't come out yet, but hopefully they'll play in Toronto and have Tampa Bay come here, because you don't want to go to Tampa. You don't want to go to Florida where they're setting records every day with new cases. So, yes, it'll be regional. It'll be like old-time baseball. It'll be like when they traveled on trains, and they're going to try to cram 60 games into 66 days. Well, that's just August and July for the old Negro Leagues, you know? So, yes, it's not as it's not optimal, and it's not as easy as it used to be, but it's just baseball. The rosters have expanded at least one player, and it'll be, I believe it'll be by three players for the first couple of weeks. And I got to tell you, they're going to go through players like, you know, we used to go through diapers in my house. They're going to need 30, 40 players. Every team will use 40 players this year.
So then
every
single
team.
They'll need to
and
expand the
rosters.
Every team
will use 80. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and they're baseball smart. They have what they call a taxi squad. They used to have this in football. They have essentially 40 guys they can use, which is smart, because a normal roster is a 25-man roster. I bet you some teams use 45. I believe football, in basketball, will need at least to double their rosters. I bet basketball teams will need 30 players, and football teams will need about 90.
Do you think that's going to happen?
I think they'll do it at whatever cost. All they're interested in doing in the winter sports is getting the playoffs in, and baseball is getting playoffs in, because that's where they make their money. And they need to make the money. You know, the players need to make the money. The owners need to make the money. And, you know, some of the support staff needs to make the money. So that said, I believe they will continue essentially at all costs. And when we talk about the coronavirus with the players especially, we're talking about probably the lowest risk group of adults you could possibly have. However, you know, the coach, the scouts, the general managers, you know, the people working in the stadiums are much higher risk. So I hope that demographic is very, very careful and takes very good care of itself. If I were, for example, Bruce Arians, Tom Brady's coach, I would not be in the same room with Tom Brady without an N95 mask and surgical gloves.
Yeah. So back to the Phillies. This is Joe Girardi's first season as manager. He's known for running a tight ship. What do you expect from him in this odd year?
I think he's going to ask players like Jake Arrieta, Aaron Nola, Rhys Hoskins, and Bryce Harper to set a very good example for the rest of a very young team and, you know, police themselves, especially on the road. You know, hey, guys, we're having a team dinner tonight in the banquet room, you know, after our day game. Hey, guys, nobody goes out tonight. We're having a, you know, we're playing Scrabble. Well, probably not the best game for baseball players. We're playing Uno. So
you're bad.
I think that the veterans on his team, and Joe's smart, and Joe was that guy on his team. He was the guy that policed the clubhouse. I believe Joe will ask those players who are able to do this, and the kinds of players who are capable and understand the importance of all this. I think he will ask them to police the club, and they will set the tone for the Phillies. I can't speak for other teams, though.
So there are a couple of changes. Just want to get to them quickly, Marcus. If a game is tied after 9 innings, extra innings begin with a runner on second base. Why?
Yeah, I just don't I understand the concept, and you're playing a lot of games in a little time. You have extra players, and you want to get out of there quickly. But I don't know that baseball we remember the, you know, 2 hours of extra innings here, the 6 hours of extra innings back in the 90s. It's just not that big a deal to me. Usually extra inning games are decided within, you know, 30 to 35 minutes. But, you know, it is what it is. If you're going to have the designated hitter in both leagues, which we probably were also going to talk about,
yeah,
you might as well start a runner on second base, because I don't believe baseball is baseball with a designated hitter anyway. So you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound.
So why the universal designated hitter?
I believe this is something that the owners want, period. They want more runs scored. They believe that fans want to see more offense. So I believe this is a way for them to float this weather balloon and hopefully keep it permanent.
Okay. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. Marcus Hayes is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. One more quick question about the Phillies before we just quickly check in with the other teams. You know, if the Phillies were to win the World Series, there's been some debate about any pro sports team winning a championship and whether there should be an asterisk. Some are arguing that if you can get through a season marked by the coronavirus, you deserve it. What do you think?
that's a good point. I mean, the asterisk for me, the thing that might devalue it is, these are marathons. The playoffs and a championship, for me, indicates not necessarily always the best team during the season, but the team that endures the grind the best. And usually, I'd say more than half the time, that is the best team. But if you have a significant injury or a rash of injuries, that's what made 2017 so special for the Eagles. There's no way they should have had that many injuries in one.
Yeah.
All that said, everybody's kind of in the same boat. And to Scott Lauber, my colleague at the Inquirer, his point is, if you are diligent and stay healthier than teams that are not diligent, that's a measure of the competitive edge this year. So you can put any sort of asterisk you want on this season, but the teams that adapt the best, the teams that have the best strategies and keep their best players healthiest and productive longest, are the teams that are going to benefit from it. It's interesting to me. And again, this is not a religion. This is not, you know, social policy. It's sports.
We have to remind ourselves of that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's just sports. And yeah, you know, the element of endurance might not be as marked, but maybe you comprise your team differently. Maybe you use your assets differently. As Joe Girardi said, usually it's a marathon. This year it's a sprint. So put your best sprinters out there.
A quick check on where we are with the other leagues. Sixers open their season against the Pacers August 1st.
That's right. That'll be that's the league that I worry the most about.
Why?
They're in a bubble, but they're in a bubble in Florida, and the knucklehead to non-knucklehead ratio in basketball is much higher than in any other sport. These guys are they have the most free time and they have the most fun. So if they are disciplined and if they make it through, considering the degree of sort of respiratory interpersonal contact they have, I will be astonished if that league manages to pull off 6 to 8 weeks in quarantine with playoffs and everybody doing what they're supposed to do.
Okay, and quickly, NFL trying to stay on target with training camp and the regular season. Just, we've got about 10 seconds.
Yeah, face masks, full face mask. Everybody's going to look like Brian Dawkins. And no, again, Mary, no spitting.
Okay, thank you. On that note, Marcus Hayes, we'll say goodbye. Always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
Marcus is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And as always, don't forget to join us on social media. You'll find us at WHYY.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers are John Ahrens, Debbie Bilder, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us for the Regional Roundup. Be well.